to place in our users' feeds, and we have long been clear that the only way we can reasonably comply with the Online News Act is by ending news availability for people in Canada.
Now, Paul, I don't want to alarm you, but since you left the country, the Canadian media industry has been not doing so hot.
Well, I am alarmed.
Has this news made it down to you in the U.S.?
No, we don't have access to any news, so I'm living in a basically hermetically sealed environment down here.
Totally understood. Well, let me give you a little bit of a recap since you haven't followed it. The Trudeau government, over the past few years, has come up with these kind of big schemes on how to fix the Canadian media industry. You may recall there was the labor tax credit. We had a digital subscription tax credit. There was the new structure of the Registered Journalism Organization, which I think we're still waiting to hear what the hell that is. But the pièce de résistance has been the Online News Act. It is the thing that's made enemies of Google and especially Meta. And it's the reason you still can't see news on Instagram. Without overcomplicating this, I'll just briefly explain. The Online News Act requires that Google and Facebook, if they ever actually agree to do it, pay out up to $100 million a year to Canadian media outlets. Either the companies will submit this money to the CRTC, who will dole it out to all of those publishers, or they're going to have to strike their own deals on how to compensate Canadian media for, apparently, all of this advertising money they've stolen over the years. Now, you heard Heritage Minister Pascal Saint-Ange there making the case that this is sort of taking it to the doorsteps of these tech giants. And I gather, Paul, that you're rather impressed with this trust-busting tactic from the Trudeau government.
Well, let me point to two things that I noted over the past week or so. And one was this report. It's an American study, but it essentially showed that there is now more fake partisan news websites. So, I mean, these are political actors, scammers, what have you, setting up fake websites that look like news sites. Then there are actual local news sites across the United States. The other one that really caught my eye was I won't get into all the details, but there's been some consolidation in the video game media industry. Now, video games are as popular as ever. The narrative around the newspapers dying is, you know, well, you guys had a chokehold on advertisers, but now then the internet came along and now you just can't fight for those eyeballs in the same way, which is bullshit. I mean, there are all kinds of sites, including these video game sites, that still pull in a massive readership. The issue is one of ad tech, is that Google and Facebook have monopolized the ad tech stack, is what you would call it. And they've done this by buying up every level of the ecosystem that undergirds the internet and how you purchase an ad online. And they also do this through rampant spying. I just want to point out that at no point was there any public debate about how we're going to let these tech companies put a microscope to our lives and then being able to monetize this, to use this against us. The reason media everywhere is dying because they do not spy on people the same way the tech companies do. And so you have to go through their system, which means they take a cut every step of the way. So no matter where your traffic is at, Google or Facebook, I mean, who have basically a mirror system, are the ones who are taking something off of the top. To me, the fact that Canada is one of the countries that is actually standing up to this tech duopoly is a positive sign. Canada was not the first. Australia was really the first. There's been some movement in the United States. This is a movement that's gaining momentum in the EU. I mean, this is a discussion we need to be having nationwide on whether or not we want two companies to be hoovering up all of the digital revenue for being platforms, while all of the people who actually create the content that makes the internet worth going to are essentially left to the poverty line and starving. So yeah, in that sense, I was very happy to see the Online News Act.
So listen, I think there's some really good points there. And I think, frankly, everything you just laid out is something that gets forgotten in this conversation all the time. Like, even when you listen to some of the politicians who endorse this act and who push for it, they do make it sound like Facebook and Google are literally taking the news away from our poor beleaguered newspapers and delivering it straight to some of the consumers, basically thieving this news content, which in the case of Google's AMP service, which is now almost dead, that was kind of true. But like, by and large, like, this is the problem. It's the ad tech thing. And I think that part of the issue that I take with the Online News Act is that it's not really structured as a penalty on an anti-competitive ad market. It's structured as a link tax. It is more or less a fee for how often news gets served through Facebook or Google. And then the government, okay, like that's, I think, a bad starting premise. But then the government comes up with this Rube Goldberg machine in order to try and kind of eke out pennies on the dollar from basically only the two biggest services that kind of then go down a series of ramps and tubes and mouse traps in order to finally wind up in the bank accounts of some, you know, sad sack papers that are on the verge of bankruptcy. And I think it's so wildly inefficient that I kind of would have much more appreciated someone coming out making the antitrust case and saying, we're going to Robinhood not just Google and Facebook, but also Amazon and Etsy and a handful of other, you know, major online companies that have just completely nuked the ad market. I think that probably would have been a more compelling case.
I mean, and the people I really blame for this is you, Justin. It's you and the pundit class in Canada. I mean, we saw what I thought was a remarkable thing. We had essentially Canadian civil society say, we do not accept the status quo. We do not think it needs to be this way that these two companies get to hoover up all of this money and don't have to return any share of their exorbitant profits to keep local news online. We believe that there should be a recognition that there is value here, that civil society depends on a certain extent on people being able to get local news, and we're going to try to make some moves to keep that alive in desperate times. And the response from the pundit class, from you and Jen Gerson and Matt Gurney and all of you, which is, oh, this is a link tax. Oh, there's, you know, and sure, the government is also did a terrible job of selling this. And they bought right into the framing of these tech companies. And what is essentially a monopoly power case. This is a market power issue that got somehow reframed as a link tax, which is just absolutely absurd from my point of view. And when Facebook said, you know what, we are just going to not do this. We are just going to say, F- to Canada, we're going to opt out. We're going to cut news off of our platform. What are you going to do about it? The overwhelming response that I saw was just, well, of course, what did you think? Why did we even try to do anything different? Why this legislation was a bad idea from the beginning? We shouldn't have rocked the boat. We shouldn't have angered these tech companies. I mean, I've been saying there's two strands I see in Canadian punditry over the last few years. One is complaining that Canada is broken, and two is opposing any efforts to actually fix anything.
I generally agree with that. But I think part of the problem from the outset is that we created a system that you can opt out of. Like, that's part of the failure of the system. But you know, the big news this week is not just that the act is kind of finally chugging along. It's that the $100 million that Google has committed has actually been allocated. And this is the news I really want to focus on, because this is, I think, a perfect example of how poorly structured and envisioned this act was from the beginning. And I'm going to be a little bit mean here. I'm putting this on the table now. I'm sure I'm going to get complaints about how awful and terrible I am for picking on these small publishers. But listen, when Google was allocating this money, it had an option of two different groups it could give the money to. And those groups would then be tasked with picking from about a list of 1,500 journalism organizations across the country who want money, figuring out how the money gets dispersed, kind of following the act, but also making a lot of judgment calls about who gets what and what the criteria are to qualify. And their options were between basically the legacy publishers, a group that included major broadcasters, the CBC, and the major newspaper publishers across the country. And the other group was this group of indie kind of ragtag community radio stations, community TV stations, online digital first outlets. And surprise, they went with the latter group, the Canadian Journalism Collective. And I'll just really quickly read you through some of the news outlets and organizations represented on this Canadian Journalism Collective. We have Pivot, a Francophone news outlet, The Resolve, the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, Village Media, which represents, fairness, a bunch of former Black media papers out west and some in Ontario, Indigenews, the Fédération des Télévisions Communautaires Autonomes de Québec, The Breach, a group called Dead End Sininivit, IndieGraph, Moose FM, Discourse Community Publishing, and the In Spirit Foundation. Which of those is your favorite, Paul?
I've long been a fan of the In Spirit Foundation.
Yeah, because you heard that one last. Here's my complaint. This is a group of publishers and outlets that frankly don't produce much news. over half of the organizations here are represented in one way, shape, or form by a group called IndieGraph. They are basically a newsletter tech company that helps build out websites for small community publishers. A bunch of these outlets don't even publish very often. They publish in some cases once a month, maybe once a week, twice a week in some cases. Some of them aren't actually journalism organizations at all. And frankly, I think it raises a bunch of questions about whether or not they have the capacity or know-how to determine who qualifies, about whether they have the right criteria in mind about who actually qualifies as a journalism organization. It's also worth noting that several of these outlets, like The Breach, for example, is, and this is not a problem, but they are a left-wing kind of progressive news outlet. Does it raise questions of fairness about whether or not conservative papers will fare as well when the collective doles out this money? I think these are really kind of valid questions, and I've heard almost nothing in the Canadian media thus far raising them or kind of asking if this was the right group to actually disperse the money or whether this was the right process. And frankly, I think it represents a pretty significant conflict of interest. Many of the organizations who are vying for this $100 million are also represented on the group that's going to be allocating the $100 million. And that to me seems like a fatal flaw in this whole system. And there's a real chance that it can get so stymied in complaints and allegations, and maybe even lawsuits, that this money might never even go out the door.
Yeah, I'm less concerned with the details of the smaller picture element of distributing this money, which is always going to be, let's face it, a certain point, you know, a haggle between different media outlets of who gets what. I think what we've learned is that this act is in itself insufficient. I think it was a reasonable assumption at the time to follow the Australian model. The Australian model seemed to be working. The miscalculation there was not realizing essentially how corrupted, how indifferent these tech companies are to the state of the countries that they're operating in. It's time, I think, for Canada to take the next step. And there are a couple different options there. I mean, we've got in California, in Maryland, there's legislation to tax digital profits, which are really tapered to go after exactly these two companies because you can create a threshold. And essentially, it is doing by force what the Online News Act is trying to do through negotiation. I would say let's go even farther. For once, let's not have Canada just follow legislative initiatives that are originated elsewhere. I think what Canada should do is take a hard look at privacy, because this is inherently a privacy issue. Mm. This is something where we can rewrite the rules of the internet. We really can. I mean, this is a topic where we can get at the heart of what allows Facebook and Google to be so dominant. The two things that I would say need to be done. One is that we need to actually break up this ad tech monopoly that they have. That's more because these are US-based companies and a US thing. But what Canada can do is essentially say, you don't just get to default spy on your users to a degree that no one can compete with you because you know more about what underwear they're wearing than anyone else could possibly know or has the right to know. Unless you want to actively, you know, pay people off, cut people in on this because their data is so valuable, that would be one thing if there was actually some sort of incentive program. But no, this is just the default that they get to do and we get nothing out of it. And I think that it shows a level of impunity and boldness that these tech companies are acting with, especially Facebook, Meta, that they are not afraid of governments actually hitting them where it hurts. This, to me, is such a winner. You get to actually go after these two huge tech companies that are the ones really behind and shitifying the internet right now. And also, you get to make this a privacy crusade. This is a genuinely important issue that we've never fully reckoned with. But this is a privacy catastrophe happening every day that either this government or the next should campaign on ending. And that will get Google and Facebook's attention.
But let's also be real, like the government isn't ready to face the consequences of what Google and Facebook are going to do.
What are they going to do? They're going to pull out of Canada? Are they going to pull out of Australia? Are they going to pull out of the US? This is not a Trudeau thing. This is an international movement that has right and left parties behind it. There are Republican states down here signing onto these big tech lawsuits. This is not a liberal initiative.
Yeah. But also the tactics you're describing, I think, go far beyond even what like the EU is contemplating.
Yes. It's Canada for once doing something ahead instead of following other people's leads. Imagine.
I'm team be as aggressive as possible, but also, like, let's talk about the consequences, right? Because, you know, Facebook's decision to block news in Canada isn't just because they don't want to comply with the Online News Act. For them, whatever, $100 million payoff would be totally appropriate in order to continue sort of sucking in users to spend their time on their shitty platforms. But this was a warning to other governments around the world. Don't think about trying this. We're not going to be bullied into it. And I suspect Google's decision, I mean, you know, I'm going to be really, really cynical here and suggest that Google's decision to hand out money to this collective, which is represented by several, like, you know, avowedly kind of left-wing progressive news outlets, a couple of news outlets I think are highly critical of the Conservative Party. I think this is an attempt to slow down the process, to wait until Pierre Poilievre gets into office, and to hope to God that he kills the whole thing, because frankly, he's probably going to. I think we are getting played here, and I think if we think we have the wherewithal to dance with them, then we should really commit to it.
Okay, here's where I agree with you. This is absolutely a warning sign to other jurisdictions saying, don't try to do what Canada did, don't try to do what Australia did. So we have the choice in front of us now of who do we want to be more powerful in the world? The democratically elected governments of Western nations or two tech companies? Because that is the choice before us. This is us talking about what we want our country to look like. Do we want local news to exist or not? Do we want people to have privacy rights or not? I don't give a what Google and Facebook think the answer to those questions are. I care what we as people decide, what our governments decide, and I do not think that we should be timid about tinkering with something like privacy laws because we're worried about the ire of Google and Facebook.
I mean, I totally agree with you, and frankly, I actually think Facebook's Meta's blackmail attempt has backfired to some degree. And I suspect it's probably not done a ton to endear Facebook to the Canadian public.
If Pierre Poilievre wins this next election, I mean, he's going to have a lot of rural voters who voted for him, who have dying local papers that do care about this stuff. I think one of the smartest things he could do is not turn around and just give Google and Facebook a win. I think he should take up this mantle like some politicians down in the US are doing. I think it would be a very, very savvy move for him.
I say this whenever I'm on the show, whenever I get in an argument with Jesse, but Canadian media doesn't just have a revenue problem. It also has a distribution problem, right? And this is why we became so beholden to Facebook and Google in the first place, because for a time, they were really reliable distribution models, mm-hmm. right? They made sure our stories got in front of eyeballs. And that's why we developed this symbiotic relationship that has now turned super toxic. And part of where I see this problem kind of colliding in the next couple of years is that we haven't figured out a good solution. Like, you know, the groups that are represented on this collective, the IndieGraph publications, they've tried to build out a new sort of distribution model, like largely through email, but also kind of through microsites and all this other stuff. And frankly, like, I wish it worked better for them, but like, I don't see a ton of success. So like, while we're always arguing about this revenue issue, we still haven't figured out the distribution problem. And that strikes me as somewhere we have to solve for, or else we're going to be both broke and no one's going to read us. And the middle ground is going to be made up by these microsites that have taken over local news markets across the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, one of the complaints about the Online News Act was that it was propping up these old legacy media outlets and blocking the way for disruption in the news media. And I mean, frankly, I just haven't seen any outlets in Canada really step up and replace the role of a mainstream newspaper, say, in terms of the breadth of what they do. I mean, Jesse Brown is rolling in his grave right now. I'm glad he's not here to hear this.
He's hunting a whale, Paul. How many times can I say this?
But I think this is part of the issue, is that, yes, people live online now, and people interface through social media now. And one of the big problems with the Online News Act and the Australian model before it is it did give unintentionally Meta and Google this leverage of we can choke off news without affecting the rest of our content. That's why I do think we need to start looking at other options, such as a digital profit tax, or, as I say, this privacy legislation, because I don't see any way that people are going to be able to reach large numbers of people without going through the internet, which for now, the internet means these dominant platforms.
Yeah. Now, before we move on, I should say I reached out to this Canadian Journalism Collective to ask a couple questions about how they plan on distributing the money and how they plan on solving for conflicts of interest. Because, again, some of those who are on the collective are also run organizations that are applying for money. They promised that in the near future, as this application is approved by the CRTC, the full agreements are going to be made public. They're going to follow the letter of the Online News Act very closely, and they're going to distribute the money roughly equivalent to the amount of full-time employees boasted by each of the applying companies. So, you know, all that's good language. It's going to require some very close coverage because, frankly, we, the Canadian media, have largely ignored this fight. If you want to get news on this, you largely have to go to Michael Geist's blog where he complains about it.
God help us.
Sometimes, well. and I think it's totally inappropriate. Like, we need to be a lot more eagle-eyed about this ongoing fight because otherwise, I think there's a real risk that this money never gets spent, no one seems a dime, and that we manage to screw up a whole bunch of this fight without ever actually getting the shakedown money that we hoped to get from it, which would be, as we often are, in the worst of both worlds.
Well, I do think the big picture is more important. I agree with you that the actual disbursement of these funds is an important issue, and I can promise you I will be the first person to raise holy hell if you receive even a dime of it.
I'm going to apply for money just to piss you off. All right, Paul, this is the segment of the show where I ask you to mention something happening in Canadian media that the rest of us has missed. So I understand you brought something in.
Yeah, well, this was something that caught my eye because I've been following this court case, really these court cases, for years brought by Blacklock's reporter against the federal government. And Blacklock's, for those who don't know, is an Ottawa-based publication that is heavily paywalled. You need to get a subscription in order to read their stories. And they have launched a series of lawsuits against the federal government saying that they essentially were illicitly obtaining Blacklock stories and then spreading them around through government departments or sometimes with outside people and essentially sued them for copyright infringement. Well, it's been a tough legal road. I mean, first of all, the federal government has tried to argue that Blacklocks are copyright trolls because they would issue these subscriptions and then they would file these access to information requests that would show that the stories were spread around. I just want to highlight that this is absolutely absurd. Blacklock's reporter is literally a mom-and-pop shop that is suing the federal government. It is an inane thought that this is somehow a money-winning proposition for them. I promise you, whatever you think of Blacklock's, these people sincerely believe that they have been ripped off, and they have been launching this legal crusade to try to get some sort of case law in place that protects media companies that rely on paywalls. Because before they launched these cases, this was an entirely untested area of law. All right, so how's it gone? Well, not great for Blacklock's. Initially, there was a case that was ruled on a few years ago that essentially carved out a fair use exemption for federal departments that were, their media monitoring departments were taking these stories. They were getting one account and then spreading them around to multiple people. The courts essentially said this falls under fair use because it was the research provision of fair use. I'm not going to get too far into that. I'm going to talk instead about this decision that just came out a week or two ago. And this is a lawsuit involving Parks Canada. So similar thing, Parks Canada, I think it was 15 stories that they were sharing around internally and in a couple cases maybe with an outside actor, and Blacklock sued. The new part of case law that came out of this is that Blacklock was essentially saying that they broke the part of the Copyright Act that essentially outlaws getting around a digital lock, what's called a technological protection measure. And what Blacklock argued was, well, we have a paywall with a password. And what they were doing is sharing these passwords around, which is clearly a circumvention of a technological protection measure. And in this very strange decision, this judge who, he essentially just bought the arguments of the University of Ottawa crowd who were interveners, saying that the password does not count as technological protection measure. This does not qualify as getting around a digital lock. This is not illegal, and this still falls under fair use. The reason I want to highlight this is because, as we just droned on about, the market for making money off of building an organic audience is very hard for any media company. So that is people turning to either a subscription model, whether that is sort of more of a donations or a hard paywall like Blacklock's. The federal government, as anyone can tell you who has worked for a paywalled organization as I do now and have in the past, these governments are some of the worst offenders at just sharing your stories widely without just actually shelling out for a group subscription.
However I feel about Blacklock's doesn't really matter. I still support their ability to make money and not have the government circumvent their paywall. But this ruling would have some really terrifying downstream effects where suddenly, you know, Netflix is suing all of us because we're sharing our passwords with each other. I tend to think that we should probably be on the side of us having more rights to the things we pay for, not less on the internet.
Look, so that's the argument of the University of Ottawa crowd. If we don't carve out these fair use rights, that Netflix is going to be suing us for sharing password. That's really not what that issue here. We're talking about a large-scale, more industrialized theft of content that government departments are doing. This is not, they're not suing individuals who shared a story.
Not yet.
And that's why I think this is so interesting, because these cases, which no one is paying attention to, are the ones that are essentially carving out what the laws around this are, because no one has taken this to court before.
It is interesting, and it is duly noted. All right, Paul, what I brought in today for our little show and tell, you know what? It's good news about the Canadian media industry, which you probably haven't seen this because it was not covered in the Canadian media really at all. But the Logic, a small, well, increasingly less small, let's call it a medium-sized online news outlet right here in Canada, which covers the Canadian innovation and tech sector. It raised $4 million in capital financing from FT Ventures. That's the Financial Times venture arm, I gather. It is a wonderful news story of an online news outlet that has been breaking stories and doing some incredible reporting left, right, and center, being recognized by a non-Canadian investment firm as a media outlet that's not just going to survive, but is actually going to grow and thrive. It is a wonderful example of a small outlet doing good, managing to finance itself, not being reliant on either government money or tech money or grants or whatever financing scheme you want to come up with. It is an outlet that has grown and expanded on the value of people paying for their news because they think it's useful and valuable. And I think it deserves a little round of applause.
You know what, Justin? That story, that's duly noted.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for joining me, Paul, taking time out of your busy schedule.
Good to see you, Justin.
You can email me at justinling@protonmail.com. I read everything, unfortunately, that you send. Paul, where can people find you?
Well, you cannot read my stuff because it's behind a paywall, so don't even think about trying to steal it. But you can follow me on Twitter if you want, at PDMcLeod. Unlike cowards like Justin, I still am on Twitter, so you can find my opinions there.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our production manager is Max Collins, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. The theme music is by Sokol. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Drawing, dancing, making music. These forms of expression are not just for people who identify as artists. Sarah Newman of the Climate Mental Health Network says they can help people explore their feelings about climate change.
This is not asking people to show up and become Pablo Picasso. This is about using different modalities to process your emotions.
For many people, thinking about climate change can provoke anxiety, anger, or fear. So Newman's Group provides resources, primarily for parents and teachers, to help young people identify and cope with these emotions. It offers a free art therapy guide in English and Spanish. The guide suggests activities, such as making collages with images that reflect what you're feeling about climate change, or dancing and moving your body to release difficult emotions.
Art therapy is a way to express one's emotions in a way that is beyond the limitations of words. And it's a way to tap into experiences and feelings that you might be having or that you might not even necessarily fully recognize.
So art can help people begin to process the many emotions evoked by the climate crisis. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.